Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Today on the Peter B. Collins podcast, we talk to a contrarian, a psychologist from Denmark.
Feelings. Nothing more than feeling.
And if your feelings are sensitive, you might want to avoid listening to this podcast. Because Sven Brinkmann is a fascinating guy who takes on the self-improvement craze in the U.S. and globally. And he's got some tough messages delivered in a very sympathetic way. And while he comes across as a bit of a crank, he's from Denmark, which was just displaced by Sweden as the happiest nation in the world. We cover a lot of interesting topics in this conversation, and it's a break from some of our typical fare here. It's made possible by subscribers like Deborah Madera, Ian Berman, Ethan Knox, and Joe Clarici. They send me a few bucks every month to keep the lights on and the phone bill paid here at the Secret Studio. And I invite you to join them. Come on over to peterbcollins.com, click menu, pull it down, click become a subscriber. It takes you to the sign-up page where you've got options. And I hope you'll choose one. Today on the Peter B. Collins podcast, we talk to a crusty contrarian from Denmark whose new book is called Stand Firm, Resisting the Self-Improvement Craze. Professor Sven Brinkmann joins me today on the Peter B. Collins podcast. Stand or fall, state your peace tonight, the song says. And as we get started, I want to give a shout out to our one identified listener in Denmark. He is Jens Ivan Nielsen, who lives on the island of Bornholm, and sends me frequent delightful emails, free verse in English. Thank you, Jens. And my guest today, as I mentioned, is Sven Brinkmann. And he is a professor of psychology at the University he studied at Aarhus, and now he is at Aalborg. And the professor has been a visiting professor at the New School in New York, at King's College London, the University Cattolica in Milan, and he has edited or written more than 25 books. So he's quite an accomplished man, and he joins us by Skype from Denmark today. Professor, thanks for being with me today.
Thanks so much for the invitation.
Well, it's my pleasure. When your publicist first sent me a blurb about the book, I responded to Lucas, and I said, this feeds my bias. And the subtitle of your book is so important, Resisting the Self-Improvement Craze. And I frequently haunt bookstores, but I am rarely found in the so-called self-help section. I just find it to be so much voodoo and snake oil and bullshit that I tend to stay away from there. And that's why your book really, really resonates with me, because you're telling people to be strong individuals and do not submit to groupthink and the idea that we all need to be feverishly working to improve ourselves every day.
Yeah. Yeah, I believe actually you can find my book in the self-help section in many bookstores. So I hope that people like you who might be inclined towards this message will still find it, even though they won't wander towards those shelves. But it's a bit ironical. It's really a book that is mimicking the self-help genre. It's a parody, in a way, of a self-help book with its seven steps. But I try to say the opposite of what many self-help books say, because I think it's actually pretty sound advice very often, not always, but quite often, to do the opposite of what we're told by the whole self-improvement industry.
Now, you don't have plans for thin thighs in 30 days. You don't tell me how to get those big bags out from beneath my eyes. But the summary of your seven steps here show up in the introduction to the book. Let me give our listeners this briefing. You you have chapters entitled Cut Out the Navel Gazing, Focus on the Negative in Your Life, Put on the No Hat, Suppress Your Feelings, Sack Your Coach, Read a Novel, Not a Self-Help or Biography, and Dwell on the Past. Now, these are counter, how can we say it, counter consensus. You are kind of stepping up for the title of Professor Cranky Pants here, Sven.
Yeah, I'm trying to be cranky and grumpy. I'm really quite a happy guy from the happiest nation in the world, Denmark. Actually, no, this week we were taken over by Norway. They are happier now than we are. But we are the second happiest nation in the world, and I'm quite a happy person in this happy nation. But I think I, as well as many others, really need a dose of negativity, of realism, because there is so much to worry about. And I think we should be allowed, or sometimes even required, to worry, to think negative thoughts and have negative feelings in order to understand the world that we're in. Of course, we shouldn't become depressed. It's not a book that will, you know, tell you how to become depressed. I have much respect for mental disorders like depression. But I think, actually, paradoxically, if you follow the advice that I give, I think it might help you against depression. Because what society now is telling the individual is that you must improve yourself. You must, constantly be on the move. Reconstruct your life, strive to become better all the time. And this is, you know, set up to fail. So everyone fails. No one can live up to this. And you only have yourself to blame when you fail, because you're not positive enough. You weren't present enough in the moment. You were too perfectionist, or whatever the individual is told. And that is actually a dangerous way of thinking that I think makes us vulnerable to stress-related disorders, depression, and anxiety. So I think my message is you don't have to improve yourself all the time. And then you're not easily disappointed when you don't live up to all these wonderful ideals. And maybe they aren't so wonderful in the first place. But
yeah, but wait a minute, Sven. Who's going to take advice from you, all right? You are a tall, thin, extremely handsome Nordic guy with facial hair. You've got command of at least two languages. I mean, come on. Who's going to say, oh, he's the guy who has been through the same kind of experience as I have and can feel my pain and offer the compassion when I need it? I mean, come on.
Yeah. No, this is a good point. My main concern about my own book is that people perceive it as elitist. You know, just as you say, I'm a professor of psychology. I pay a lot in taxes in Denmark. And so who am I to tell people this? But I really think that everyone, or almost everyone, feels this pressure that we're under to constantly improve on ourselves, to become fitter and happier and more productive. This is actually from a Radiohead song.
Mm-hmm.
This line.
Yeah.
And we are left alone in this empty pursuit. And I can really say I have had so many since the book was published in Denmark. Now it's translated into several languages. But from Denmark alone, I have had literally hundreds of emails from people in difficult life situations saying, finally, someone who's saying this, who doesn't tell me to pull myself together and just think positive thoughts, and it's my own fault that I'm in this mess because I weren't happy enough or whatever. Finally, someone who accepts that there is a tragic dimension to life. I think this is the first step towards sanity, you know, to accept the realities.
And Sven, let me confess that I'm speaking to you from the cradle of the personal growth movement here in the San Francisco Bay Area. We spawned EST, the Erhard Seminars Training Program, which was a bizarre cult, synonym. Yeah. The Moonies, Reverend Moon and the Unification Church set up shop here and lingered for more than 30 years. Scientology is, based here in California, more Southern California, but quite prevalent here in the Bay Area. And, of course, right now we're taking on the greatest evil on earth, gluten, to try to purify the lifestyles of the rich and pure already. So tell me from your cozy post there in Denmark, just how loony do you regard Americans who spend thousands? I mean, Scientologists will spend tens, if not over $100,000, to get clear. And all they've done is hook up to a little thing that somebody could have gotten from Radio Shack that, you know, checks your voltage. and they go through layers of courses, and many of them are, you know, penniless by the time they get clear. They're clear, but they're poor.
No, of course, this from my perspective, and I have great respect for cultural differences. And, you know, just as people who practice voodoo in Haiti, I don't want to say that they are crazy. And so people who practice these, for me, quite strange things in California, I won't say that you're crazy or that they are crazy. You know, this is sort of an ethnographic or a social anthropological relativism that I think we all need to have. But the problem with the Californian self-improvement practice is that it strikes a country like Denmark. We don't get voodoo practices from Haiti, but all the madness that goes on that you just mentioned, we have this in a country like Denmark. We normally we say that whatever happens in the U.S. Will happen in Denmark 10 to 15 years later, and it has been consistently so since the countercultures of the 60s and 70s. So that's why I think we really need to look from Europe and Denmark to the United States. What is going on? What are you doing with the whole life coaching thing, positive thinking? Well, this is old news, obviously, with Norman Vincent Peale. He wrote this bestseller in 52 about the power of positive thinking. So it has, a long history now. But we do get this in my part of the world. And I really do think that it's deeply problematic. It's deeply individualistic. It's narcissistic. It tells you that you can achieve whatever you want to achieve, which is obviously false. And then you only have yourself to blame when you fail, and you fail all the time. So I think it's sort of an ideology that really serves to keep people on the toes, in a way to control them. Some sane Americans like Barbara Ehrenreich. I don't know if you're familiar with her. She wrote the book called Smile or Die.
Oh, sure. I know. I know Barbara. I've interviewed her several times. She's brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, she's great, and she really sees this whole ideology as a way in which the rich people oppress the poor. And so it's not just a matter of having fun with positive thinking or whatever. It's really very serious. It's in all workplaces, this thing. It's in our schools, in many parts of the world. And it's teaching us to put ourselves first and believe in ourselves instead of, and now I'm being a bit trivial or banal, instead of believing in each other and helping each other.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really, for me, a problematic ideology that doesn't have sufficient ethical underpinnings.
And Sven, since you mentioned Barbara Ehrenreich, she wrote a powerful book about her own experiences with breast cancer and her very strong discomfort with these commercialized cancer support groups, and that, wearing a pink ribbon is not going to change the ugly process of radiation or chemotherapy for a breast cancer patient. And I really value her voice, and she is a kind of established, I wouldn't call her crank, but more of a contrarian. She wrote a great book about living at the minimum wage, where she took low-paying jobs and tried to subsist on them. So I certainly value her voice. Now let me turn to a couple of your chapters, and let's put them together for our discussion here. The first chapter about cut out the navel-gazing, and a later chapter about sack your coach. And I don't know if you're familiar with American television very much. I know you've spent a little bit of time here. But we had a long-running sitcom hosted by an actor named Bob Newhart. And he played a shrink, a psychologist who, you know, did talk therapy. And it was very funny, and he did it for years. And then later on, he did a guest shot on a comedy show. It was on Mad TV, if I remember correctly. And he would just have a series of patients come in, and they would present their weepy problem. And he would just cut through all the crap. There was no psychobabble, no talk about your feelings. He just said, well, why don't you stop it? You know, whatever the behavior was that they were, you know, putting on the couch that day. And I think this is the kind of tough, a kind of tough love approach where you're saying, look, there are serious psychological issues that require therapy, but there are many people who simply need attention and who are, you know, either creating or magnifying issues that they face so that they have a reason to go to therapy. And we do have people who are, if not addicted, you know, pretty heavily dependent on therapy and self-help. And even people who are recovering from addictions, for example, sometimes trade AA for a crutch that is arguably better than alcohol, but it is still a crutch.
No, I think this is a good point. I'm a psychologist. I'm not a clinical psychologist. I think of myself as a social psychologist trying to understand psychological phenomena in their cultural and social manifestations. So as a psychologist, I wouldn't say that the answer to all depressions, all people suffering from anxiety or whatever should be, well, stop it. Because I know that some people simply just cannot stop it. But I also know that some people will, in fact, benefit from being told something like this. So I think we should be careful not to develop some kind of one-size-fits-all model here. But I agree. You know, some people become addicted to self-help. They become addicted to, in a way, what I call navel-gazing in the book, to feeling themselves, tuning in onto themselves all the time. There is actually, I'm thinking now of a psychologist, I think he's from California, actually, but he's a very good researcher. His name is Philip Cushman. He wrote a book in the 90s called Constructing the Self, Constructing America. And he's also a therapist. And he says, the problem now is that we tell people that the answers are within themselves, are inside. You should only feel what's inside, listen to your inner voice, get in touch with yourself. And then people have been sitting in therapy rooms and elsewhere for decades trying to feel themselves. And he says, this guy, Phil Cushman, that at some point they become numb. You know, they try to feel so much inside themselves that they can no longer feel anything. And then they really become depressed, because then there is no meaning. If meaning is found inside yourself in your inner voice, and you cannot hear it and you cannot feel it, then there is no meaning. So, and this in a way is a cure for depression and many other mental disorders. The cure is about turning away from yourself. The problem with, you shouldn't take this the wrong way, but many mental disorders, I think, are in a way very narcissistic. People are self-absorbed, and that's part of the problem. Mm-hmm. So they need to get away from themselves, connect with other people. Of course, this is difficult, but it's the key. So instead of waking up every morning, as I know some people who are treated with depression, and the therapist is telling them, oh, when you wake up in the morning, try to do it slowly. Try to really feel yourself. Try to, you know, listen to what your inner voice is telling you. Will it be a good day? And then they begin to listen. And of course, their body, their system will tell them, this is awful. This will be a bad day. And so it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy very easily. Mm-hmm. So the solution, as I see it, and I'm sorry if I'm rambling now, but it's really to get away from yourself, connect with something else, other people, obviously, communities, engage in activities with others, go out into nature, whatever, political activities. So as I see it, many of our problems stem from a profound alienation, emptiness, loneliness that we have in our society. And it's the tragedy is that it's made even worse by the solutions that we offer to people, because these solutions, you know, just tell them that if the problem is alienation and loneliness, then solution is even more of that, because you have to do it yourself, to tune into your own thoughts and feelings.
Well, I certainly echo your point here. I think that there are many people who get caught up in a kind of emotional soup, and they never really, to borrow the Scientology term, get clear of it. They turn more inward instead of reaching out to family and real friends, not just the people who talk to you on Facebook, and you know, really engaging. And I've often told people, well, why don't you go volunteer somewhere? Because you're going to find people who have problems more serious than yours, and that's actually going to help you. Because you'll say, well, I'm able to cope every day, and, you know, here are people who need help. And so I think that you make very strong points, and really you can ease back on your diplomacy here. we're not going to come after your degree or your licenses. So let me take issue with the chapter called Suppress Your Feelings. You write, contrary to what you will sometimes hear, it's vital that humans are able to feel guilt and shame. If we are incapable of guilt, we can't understand ourselves as moral agents with responsibility for our own actions, especially our misdeeds. Guilt tells us we've done something wrong. Even if the emotion is negative, it's absolutely indispensable to living our lives fully. And a little bit later you say, parents are constantly trying to shield their offspring from feelings of guilt and shame. These are the very emotions that lead the child into a moral universe in which he or she will hopefully evolve bit by bit into a responsible stakeholder. Now, my experience with guilt was I grew up in Roman Catholic schools, and I felt there was a whole insidious system of trying to impose guilt on people for behavioral control. And I flatly rejected it, and I do not promote guilt. I certainly have, you know, a baseline sense that if I wrong somebody, I feel bad about it. But I think there are a lot of people who have, you know, heaped shame and guilt upon themselves for, you know, what I would consider to be pretty minor faults. And so my feeling is that guilt and shame are certainly essential, but they are often exaggerated, and I think that leads to certain kinds of deviant behavior.
Yeah, I agree. I think one of the psychological tragedies that we have as humans is that the people who ought to feel ashamed and who ought to feel guilt don't. And the people who actually do feel shame or guilt shouldn't. If you have been abused as a child, for example, it's very common, sadly, to react with feelings of shame as an adult. Of course, that is wrong. And you can go into therapy. And if you have a good therapist, he or she will help you to get rid of the feeling of shame, because it's not warranted. You did nothing wrong. But in other contexts, I think it's a sad fact, too, that people who really misbehave, who really do shameful things, don't feel shame. So I think we should really learn to fine-tune our emotional radar. I think the best theory or metaphor that we have in psychology of human emotional life is that our emotions function somewhat like a radar. And if that radar is fine-tuned, you can actually trust it to some extent. You can trust that when you feel guilt, it's because you did something wrong, and that will help you, make an apology and try to improve. And if you feel shame, it's actually because you did something shameful. But the problem is that our radars are not fine-tuned. They're not because our emotional lives are often confused. For example, when we are told to think positive, feel positive emotions, even when there's nothing to be positive about. And it's no coincidence that the key characteristics of antisocial personality disorder or the psychopath is that he or she is more often a he, cannot feel guilt, cannot feel shame. So we don't really, we know when we think about it, that a person who lacks the capacity for these emotions is somehow wrong. It's not an ideal human being. So we should really get things right. So my worry is that because so many people, and you tell your own story, and I can tell many other stories, have bad experiences concerning these emotions, then my worry is that we simply throw them away, and we throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Mm-hmm.
Because these emotions are crucial for our humanity. We cannot live together in communities in reasonable and decent ways without these emotions. We really need to feel what our actions do to others. And these emotions are the radar that informs us about these things.
And I fully agree with you that many of the people who need to expand their capacity to feel shame have their shame glands completely turned off. But we also have a new phenomenon that's fueled by the internet, where we have groupthink and demagoguery imposed on people, because if you step out of line, then the shame police come after you big time. And the best example I can offer is that I'm a very progressive individual, Sven, and I did not support Hillary Clinton for president last year. And as it became a two-person race and the obvious defects and bizarreness of Donald Trump really set in, people got really aggressive using shame. How can you not support Hillary Clinton when you have this demon over here who is clearly, a greater evil? And so people really tried to use that to blow past all of the logical reasons that I've advanced for my non-support of Hillary Clinton. And yet they want to say, well, that doesn't matter. This is a terrible threat to our nation, and you've just got to shut up and fall in line. And so the group use of shame, again, fueled by digital tools, I think has become a pretty scary phenomenon.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. And this is a phenomenon that we see in so many different contexts. I think it's important in that, if I can borrow the term from my own book, to stand firm and say, well, I've done nothing wrong. What I do and what I believe is nothing shameful. So we can actually have a real conversation. We can have a discussion about this instead of just, positioning each other emotionally in this way. I think this is really harmful. But I also think that we should be allowed to look at someone like Donald Trump. And obviously, I mean, he's the whole world is discussing this character now. And I've read a bit about his past, and as many people have, of course, not that I've come up with something new, but he's very interesting in the context of what we're talking about now, because as you know, he grew up in Manhattan, and the church that he attended had Norman Vincent Peale as a minister, and he wrote this book from 52 called The Power of Positive Thinking.
Right.
And when you look in that book, Trump has called it, it's a fantastic book, and I could listen to Peale for hours and hours and hours. He was in charge of the ceremony when Trump married his first wife. So they really knew each other. Peale died many years ago now. But I think you can find the roots of this Trumpian attitude in the power of positive thinking. If you look at the chapters in the book, it's all about believing in yourself. It's all about bending reality to suit whatever images you have. You know, so when Trump says this is the largest crowd ever,
right,
he's trying to bend reality in a positive direction for him. I don't want to diagnose Trump, and I know that there's a huge discussion in the U.S. about, should we look at him in psychiatric terms? And I think I agree with Alan Francis, who was in charge of the DSM-4, the previous psychiatric manual, who says that we shouldn't diagnose Trump. We should talk about him as immoral. We should talk about his misogyny and his racism and all this, but we shouldn't pathologize him. And I agree with that. But he's, as I see him, and as an American, I'm sure you have more knowledge about it, but he seems truly incapable of shame, doesn't he?
I mean, he
lies, and he just doesn't care.
Mm-hmm.
He lies, and millions of people watch this, and he knows that they're watching it, and still he doesn't care.
Well, and so, he's trying to tell the people who propelled him to office that daddy knows what's best, and we're going to cut back on health care, and it's going to be beautiful, and we're going to stop spending money on delivering meals to people who are homebound, and it's going to be beautiful. He tries to spin up that everything he does is just incredible, awesome. In fact, I have a book of superlatives here that I sometimes use when I'm trying to describe Trump. I certainly take your point on that. Now, let me turn to another chapter, which I enjoyed, called Suppress Your Feelings. And in it, at one point, you say that suppressing emotions can damage self-esteem, according to some, because you learn that your emotions may be wrong. And you go on to say, in fact, there's a great deal of evidence to suggest that the biggest social problems stem not from low, but from high self-esteem, which is statistically associated with psychopathy and immorality. Now, I find this very interesting, and let me cite the work of my dear friend, the late John Vasconcelos. I don't know if his name ever crossed the Atlantic and got your attention, but he spent more than 30 years as a legislator here in California, and he was deeply ridiculed, including in Doonesbury cartoons, because he put forth a commission on self-esteem, and they held hearings. And his fundamental was that if we treat people as fundamentally good, and that is our worldview, more often than not, they will live up to that expectation. But when, as a government or as a culture, we view people as defective and likely to fail, they will typically follow that expectation down the dark hole as well. So I know that the self-esteem thing can be taken too far, but I have to say that in my own life, the self-confidence that I felt my parents helped me develop has been one of the greatest assets in all the things that I've done. And I don't consider myself excessively egotistical. Some might disagree. Some of my listeners might disagree.
I love that.
But I really think that healthy self-confidence, if we call it self-esteem, that's similar. I think that that is the key to being able to navigate in society.
I think everyone, all children, should learn that they are worthy of being loved, and they should be loved, not because of what they do, but because of the simple fact that they are humans. So this is the ideal for me. And if you want to call that building self-esteem, then I have no problems with that. I mean, that's fine. This is fundamental for all, human development, that children have this belief that we install, if you will, the belief in every child that she or he is good enough and worth something. even when they fail. They're not a failure because they fail. But my problem with self-esteem is that this is very often taken and transformed into a technique, which is then used, as I see it, as an excuse for actually solving our problems. So educationalists, teachers, psychologists, therapists are trying to, even with adults, to build self-esteem in people directly, instead of teaching them skills or whatever. I don't think you can really do that. It becomes very instrumentalized. It becomes very hollow. And again, it tells people that if they fail, it's because they don't have enough self-esteem. It's because of their mindset. And so it easily directs our attention away from the social issues. And everything, all problems become individuals' problems.
Mm-hmm.
So we psychologize many political issues through the self-esteem discourse, if you will. And someone like Donald Trump, whom we talked about before, I mean, I don't know how he would perform on a test for self-esteem, but I think he would, go through the ceiling. He has so much self-esteem. He believes so much in himself, which to me, someone who disagrees with Trump and his politics, simply shows that it has no value in itself.
But you're the psychologist here, Sven. isn't he overcompensating for an incredibly obvious trait of insecurity? He's always overstating everything, and that's why this satirical meme that is very much alive in the country today is to make fun of his hands, because he tried to use his hands to suggest that he's got a big dick. And I really don't care about his endowment, but
it's not really that important for his politics.
But it is interesting that people suspect that is his Achilles heel, so to speak, and that the biggest way to cut him down to size is to make him defensive about his manhood.
Yeah. No, I think, 20 years ago, this would have been the analysis. When people believed in Freud and psychoanalysis and psychodynamic thinking, they would talk about, compensating and overcompensating and all this. I think it's very, very speculative. I first got interested, and I should say I'm no expert on self-esteem, but I became interested in the phenomenon as a, you could say, a cultural issue, when one of my master's students did her thesis on self-esteem, and she actually read pretty much every study that had been done about self-esteem, all the correlations that had been made, and to her surprise, because she really liked the concept at first, but it turned out that it did not correlate with all the problems that we tend to think about, crime or anorexia, all these things that are associated in the popular discussions with low self-esteem. The studies said that the real problem is high self-esteem. When people score high on these self-esteem tests, they often act like Trump characters. So what to do about that? Well, maybe the test is wrong. I don't know. But as long as we measure it in this way, I really believe that the problem is not low self-esteem. It's high self-esteem. So if we just boost people's self-esteem without content, tell people that, oh, you're so great, no matter what you do, then it's dangerous, I think, because it actually teaches people that whatever they want, whatever preferences they have, it's good because it's their preferences. But what if they have immoral preferences? Then it's not good to have the preferences. Then it's not good to be authentic and do whatever you want. So this whole idea that you can be whatever you want is dangerous, sometimes not because it's false, which it often is, but sometimes it's true. And then it's dangerous because it's true. Trump, he's become exactly what he probably dreamed of. And that's why it's dangerous. He succeeded.
Yeah.
So I think this is the problem of self-esteem, and pretty much the basic problem in most psychological concepts. They don't have ethical content. We just tell people that if they want something, it's legitimate because they want it. You can go to, I mean, the most extreme version of this is another of your countrymen, Anthony Robbins,
sure.
Famous coach, life coach.
Right.
He says that success is doing what you want, where you want it, with whom you want it, as much as you want it. The only thing he doesn't talk about is what you want. You know, what if you want something that is not worth wanting? Then you're still successful if you do it as much as you want, with whom you want. I think this is this is very problematic and connected in a way to this whole self-esteem movement.
Well, and I agree that self-esteem cannot be manufactured. It's not something that you can buy because you went to a hotel seminar with Tony Robbins. I fully agree. And the other angle that I would offer here, Sven, is that I think that we have the boomer generation, my generation of parents, really didn't understand how their self-esteem evolved. And they thought that in many cases, I don't want to make a broad generalization, but I've seen it in too many cases, where by protecting your child from any kind of failure and any kind of disappointment, that's going to preserve the kind of natural dose of self-esteem that they were born with. And it's taken to an extreme where, you know, the losing team in Little League gets a trophy. That's to make sure that, you know, no little Johnny is going to suspend his ambition to play in the big leagues. Well, as you point out, not everybody can be a superstar or excel in any particular way. And you really offer a dose of realism and encourage people to assess themselves accurately instead of against some kind of a blue sky or model that has been falsely created to sell books.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we should our children to deal with feelings of disappointment. It's not dangerous when you do not succeed. It's part of life. Ultimately, we do not succeed in life because we will die. And before that, if we are lucky enough to be old, we become ill from time to time and helpless. And the people we love die. So I know I'm now painting a very dark picture, but it's really a realistic picture. This is what life is. Of course, we also have, hopefully, many moments of joy and happiness. But, you know, eventually we will die. And we should learn to live with that. And we should teach our children, maybe not exactly this lesson when they're small, of course, but to deal with the realities of life. And I don't think we do that. As you know, the examples you give are very good. We're so afraid that they are disappointed or anxious or sad. And yes, these feelings can become pathological, but I think the risk that they become pathological is greater if we don't, you know, if our children do not get acquainted with them before they actually do hit, and then they hit hard.
Well, so, in my own life, I have learned as much, if not more, from my failures as I have from my successes. And that's something, if you protect a child or a loved one from obvious failure, they're not going to get that insight and figure out how they'll avoid doing that in the future.
Yeah, exactly. This is also when I mentioned the emotional radar as my favorite metaphor for emotional life. Our emotional radar should also be tuned into to these aspects of life that have to do with disappointment and failure and learning to live with that.
Well, Sven, I want to thank you for a great conversation. As you can tell, I found your book fascinating, provocative, and it continues to feed my bias. I hope that people will find your book. Do you know in the U.S. where the best distribution points are? Is it on Amazon or at local stores?
I think on Amazon.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. It's from Polity Books. It's called Stand Firm, Resisting the Self-Improvement Craze. We've been talking with Sven Brinkmann. Thank you very much, Professor.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Well, I've been resisting self-improvement for a long time. I welcome your feedback, Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.